You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Well, here we are in Advent already, and with it comes lectionary readings that are full of fire and brimstone and apocalyptic visions. So especially with a passage like our reading today, I think it's good to put things into some literary and historical context. On our first century timeline, the crucifixion is in 30, and the temple is destroyed in 70. Today's story is set right here, right before the crucifixion. But here's what you need to keep in mind. Mark and Luke were writing here, influenced by both Hebrew scripture and the very real horror of the Roman destruction of Jerusalem. While it's a minority opinion at this point, there's growing evidence to suspect that Luke may have even been written here. That's about 120 in the second century. Suffice it to say, that's at least a 40 to 50 year gap between the actual events and them being written about. This passage is part of Luke's effort to salvage the prediction of Mark's Jesus about the temple's future. Right before our passage, Jesus predicts that not one stone will be left upon another. And they ask him, "Teacher, when will this be?" And Jesus exhorts his disciples to endure whatever happens. And when they see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, they will know that its desolation has come near. This was probably pretty easy for both Luke and Mark to imagine, as they were both of a generation that knew the terror of a Roman siege and probably heard from survivors about the total destruction of Jerusalem. This is not the language of accurate prediction. Remember, our gospel writers are writing at least 50 years after Jesus and maybe a decade after Jerusalem's actual destruction. So like 9/11 is for Americans who witnessed it, there's still this sense of potential doom mixed with anger and fear, the kind of fire that we humans tend to keep stoked deep within at every opportunity. So even though Luke is writing when Jerusalem is already destroyed, Luke offers a glimmer of hope by dipping back into Hebrew scripture and invoking the book of Daniel's apocalyptic figure of the Son of Man coming in a cloud. Not a literal event, mind you, but one that is more akin, I think, to a spiritual aha moment. Along with the pretty obvious fig tree parable, "When fruit trees blossom, spring is here," duh, there are lots of warnings in our passage today that easily transfer, I think, into our everyday lives. And Eugene Peterson makes sure that we hear them in everyday language. See if you can't hear a critique of our self-indulgence and how our vested interests in sustaining our lifestyles could maybe, just maybe, be at the expense of people trapped in poverty, both locally and on a global scale.
Our words of wisdom today are from Luke chapter 21, verse 25 through 36. "It will seem like all hell has broken loose. Sun, moon, stars, earth, sea, in an uproar, and everyone all over the world is in a panic. The wind knocked out of them by the threat of doom, the powers that be quaking."
"And then they'll see the Son of Man welcomed in grand style, a glorious welcome. When all this starts to happen, up on your feet, stand tall with your heads high, help is on the way."
He told them a story. "Look at a fig tree. Any tree, for that matter. When the leaves begin to show, one look tells you that the summer is right around the corner. The same here. When you see these things happen, you know God's kingdom is about here. Don't brush this off. I'm not just saying this for some future generation. For this one too, these things will happen. Sky and earth will wear out. My words won't wear out.
But be on your guard. Don't let the sharp edge of your expectations get dulled by parties and drinking and shopping. Otherwise, that day is going to take you by complete surprise, spring on you suddenly like a trap, and it's going to come on everyone, everywhere, at once. So whatever you do, don't go to sleep at the switch. Pray constantly that you will have the strength and wits to make it through everything that's coming and end up on your feet before the Son of Man. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Thanks be to God.
Not many of us have flown recently, but when you do, take a moment and see if you can spot any of the increasingly sophisticated security measures being rolled out at the airport. Biometric programs, including facial recognition systems and fingerprint and iris scanners, are already in various stages of being tested. One's civil liberties aside, the idea is when you're checking in at one of those self-serve kiosks, your iris and fingerprints are scanned and then cross-checked with a massive database looking for people with hostile intent. Then there are the TSA's BDOs, or Behavior Detection Officers, who, in a program rife with racial profiling problems, have been trained to single out people who are acting suspiciously for extra screening. Along with the passive machines that analyze you for sharp changes in body temperature, rapid pulse and breathing, and a camera that measures minute facial and eye movements, we are really well-observed travelers. So, between being stressed about lurking viruses, anxious about our personal lives, apprehensive about the world in general, and uncertain about making the flight in time, let alone whether or not we remember to put our toothpaste in that little baggie, chances are that most of us would be in for some questioning about what's freaking us out. So, let's be honest. This apocalyptic passage today feels pretty close to home. It's got anxiety all over the place. The whole cosmos is in an anxious uproar. Luke's Jesus says, people will faint from fear and from foreboding of what is coming. And remember our timeline. Luke can write about this with confidence because it's already happened. But Luke might as well have been writing about today. It seems that everything in our culture is amping up the fear angle. Online and other media have transitioned to a new style of headline even, and they've changed for a reason. There are those who have now made a science of what's called clickbait to tempt you to click on their story over others. They know that 8 out of 10 people will read your headline, but only 2 out of 10 will read the rest of your copy. And what's been learned is that what used to define a good headline now fails miserably as clickbait. So, terrifying headlines are the goal. Misleading headlines are the goal. Headlines that can be taken in a variety of ways are the goal. Today, instead of presenting facts, headline writers try to stir up emotions. And the top 3 emotions that headline writers are taught to evoke are, in order, greed, fear, and anger. In an article titled How to Sell Using Fear, ad man Drayton Bird says, fear is persuasive. It's automatic and, to some extent, out of our control. It's built into our operating system as a defense mechanism from the old days, when the most important question was, can I eat it or can it eat me? Fear gets people to take action. During the early part of the Cold War, it was common, some of you might remember, for teachers to instruct students on what to do in the event of a nuclear war. If the air raid sirens ever went off, all students needed to do was duck and cover. It seems absurd today, but that was the expectation. And in many ways, it served only to deepen a sense of fear and dread in a whole generation. But in our passage today, Jesus' advice seems to be just the opposite of duck and cover. Stand up and raise your heads. This life has things to be feared, no doubt about that. But we should stay alert and help others do the same. Why? Because the more people are afraid, the more easily they're manipulated into doing things that are against their best interest, contrary to their values, or inhumane to other people. Let me say that again. The more people are afraid, the more easily they're manipulated into doing things that are against their best interest, contrary to their values, or inhumane to other people. I don't know about you, but that sounds a lot like what we've been living through. People are afraid. And advertisers, journalists, politicians, and so many religious folks are happy to leverage that fear to gain market share and rally the troops. Fear is like an incantation. Invoke it often enough, or tweet it often enough, and you'll gain complete control over your subjects. Theologian Rob Bell has observed, if you feed fear, it only gets hungrier. On the news and social media, you have people saying, they're the enemy, and others saying, no, they're the enemy. Then you have other people saying, I think you're the enemy because you say those people are the enemy. It's a virtual fear industry that is being stoked, not only by the 24-hour news cycle, but by sophisticated analysis of what gets people's attention. And media-savvy online influence operations can manipulate the actions of micro-targeted demographic communities or whole countries. As Rob Bell goes on to say, it's burning an incredible amount of energy with no progress whatsoever. But here's the unexpected thing about fear. It's also a gift. Think back about that evolutionary development of our brain. You're sitting right here, right now, wherever you are, because your ancestors were able to identify the threat of a large animal in the bushes right there and run the other way. Hooray for you! Those that didn't have that skill set, well, let's just say that they weren't around long enough to pass on their traits. So at one level, fear is a gift. It helped us survive to this point as a species. But, says Bell, if you feed fear and you move way beyond the gift that helped us to survive and start passing it around and ruminate on it and dwell on it and you feast on it, all it does is make you more fearful. And that doesn't help anybody. Fear loves to find new enemies, loves to argue, loves to take this extraordinary gift that is your life and waste your energy on ridiculous debates and discussions that go nowhere. Let me ask you this. Do you know what the most common command in the Bible is? Let me give you a hint. It isn't about money. It's not about heaven and hell or sex or hypocrisy, none of that tabloid stuff. Think about any of the times an angel shows up in the story. They always begin with the same command over and over. Be not afraid. That's it. Over 400 times before I lost count. Fear not. Don't be afraid. Chill. And wow, calm down. Variations on that. But it doesn't end there. Bell points out that almost inevitably, the be not afraid bit is followed by God has something important for you to do. So whatever the setting, whatever the trauma, God doesn't indulge you with, oh, everything's going to be all right. I'll take care of it. No, it's more like one of my favorite passages from the Book of Hesitations. Stop your whining. We've got a whole world to heal here. You only get a few years, so get off your duff and get to work. In the end, even in the face of uncertainty, terror, and fear, we have to ask, what kind of world are we making? How can I use the sacred gift that is my life in helping make the world a less fearful place? Often attributed to Nelson Mandela, it's actually a quote from Marianne Williamson in Return to Love, where she writes, "Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. Your playing small does not serve the world. There's nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We are all meant to shine. It's not just in some of us, it's in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others." And one more from Rob Bell. Quote, "More than ever, a calm, centered, peaceful response is required. This is who I am. This is why I'm here. This is the work I'm going to do. And I'm not going to live in fear." Unquote. So I hear you saying, let me get this straight. We've just had a nice Thanksgiving. We've started putting up the Christmas decorations. And you start talking about fear and the end of the world. Well, yeah, because it's Advent. And the message of Advent is to keep awake. It's getting darker and darker. Things are getting scary. That's why we light a new candle each week of Advent, to push back the darkness. Advent says, don't give in to the angst doctrine. Resist that fear. On the church's calendar, a new year begins today. And we're called precisely at the moment that all seems lost to re-envision the renewal of the world. Global catastrophes are real and regular occurrences. No matter what the fundamentalists say, they are not prelude to a literal coming again of the Son of Man, but rather issues about which we can do something. But we have to overcome our fears. And this is a two-parter. First, whenever you get a chance, debunk that pernicious Christian fantasy about a supernatural Christ coming on the clouds to set all things right. Not happening. Sorry, TV preachers. Secondly, it's about stirring up the spirit of Christ in each of us, to casting out the fears that are hobbling us and letting that same spirit inspire us to be on about the renewing and transformation of the world. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear because fear has to do with punishment. The one who fears is not made perfect in love. According to Jesus, the two most important commandments are to love God with all that we are and to love our neighbors as ourselves. Wherever there is fear in our lives, that is the part of us where we haven't allowed the Spirit to have its sway, and thus a part of us that cannot be used as a conduit of grace to those around us. So, wherever we allow fear to continue to exist, be it in our heart or in the world, that is where we remain disconnected from the greatest calling on our lives. One day, Mullah Nasruddin was walking along a deserted road. As night was falling, he spied a troop of horsemen galloping toward him. His imagination began to work overtime, and he feared the worst. They might rob him, or impress him into the army, or kill him. So strongly did his fear possess him that he ran and leapt over a wall and found himself rather poetically cowering in what turned out to be a graveyard. The riders, innocent of any such motive as had been assumed by Nasruddin, had from a distance seen a man run from the road and scramble over a wall. They became curious, and so they stopped to see if Nasruddin was okay, which, of course, terrified Nasruddin all the more. When they came upon him lying motionless and trying to be invisible, one of the riders asked, "Can we help you? Why are you here in this position?" Nasruddin, realizing his mistake, admitted, "It's both more complicated and more simple than you think. You see, I am here because of you, and you are here because of me." When it comes to fear, where do we find ourselves? It's really more simple than you think. Now, more than ever, a calm, centered, peaceful response is required from each of us. As followers of Jesus, our commitment is to being on about healing the world, to unapologetically say, "This is who I am. This is why I'm here. This is the work I'm going to do, and I am not going to live in fear." Be well. And be not afraid.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.